Welcome back. This is Kelly Gregg of KellyGreggGregg.com, and this is the first podcast of the series Health Topics by Kelly Gregg. Many of you are familiar with my other line of podcasts, that being Diet and Health by Kelly Gregg, which is a condensed version of my book Diet and Health, which is the purpose of these podcasts, that being trying to get you to buy my book, Diet and Health, on Amazon. I occasionally get tired of going through the book, and I like to do podcasts on other subjects for fun. This is actually a small article I submitted for a magazine, and it was rejected. But I like the article so much, and I'd already done the work, so I decided to reproduce it here in the podcast. Today I'm going to talk to you about tampons and cancer. Well, actually, it's about powder and cancer, or bacteria and cancer, basically anything that goes into the vagina. Before I can do that, I am going to have to teach you some lingo and anatomy. I know you think you understand every nuance of your anatomy, but some, if not most, overlook a boring portion of the anatomy book. First, we need to understand the peritoneal cavity. First, let's pretend you don't have one, and this is pretty easy to do since nobody really gives it a second thought. Now, say I stick a big, floppy, empty latex balloon underneath your abdominal wall muscles. The balloon is quite large and really has nothing in it except a little slippery fluid that enables us to slide around the inside walls. In other words, if you rub the balloon from the inside would slide around. Now let's start to inflate the balloon with a little low pressure of air. Before we started doing this, we covered the outside of the balloon with a bunch of sticky stuff. As we slowly inflate the balloon, you can see how it would stick to the top of the abdominal wall. The balloon also sticks to the liver, stomach, spleen, ovaries, uterus, on top of and around the blood vessels serving these organs, and inserts itself into every nook and cranny. Eventually, everything in the abdominal cavity is either inside the balloon or outside the balloon. If we let the air out, we would simply have a potential space there, but everything would be next to the corresponding organs, just like before we inserted the balloon. Now, let's say we were doing a laparoscopy on someone, and most of you have a vague idea of what a laparoscopy is. We stick a needle into the skin and through the abdominal wall muscles, and begin to inflate this potential space with air. Eventually, your abdomen expands, and we have a space inside your body. We can now stick a tube in there and look around. The peritoneal cavity is very thin, hence it doesn't obstruct our view of any of the organs that have been stuck to the lining of the peritoneal cavity. In fact, we could take a bite out of one of these organs, but none of the air would escape, as the lining has stuck to the organs, hence there's no place for the air to go. We can now do lots of stuff through this potential space. We can look around and make sure there's no problems. We could take out somebody's gallbladder. We could do a tubal ligation. We could do an appendectomy. There's no end to the number of things we can do looking around inside this space. We could let the air out and put fluid in there if we wanted to. If we left it there, your body would eventually absorb all the fluid through the lining into the capillaries on the outside of the balloon. So this is the peritoneal cavity, or really for the most part, it's a potential cavity. But now the interesting part. The female of our species has access to this potential space. You probably guessed it, the fallopian tube opening is actually inside this potential space. So there is a conduit from the outside of the body up through the vagina, the uterus, fallopian tubes, to inside the peritoneal cavity. Now, this is not a very easy access. I mean, oftentimes the cervix has mucus occluding it. The endometrium sometimes is full of blood and all kinds of cells. The fallopian tubes themselves are pretty teeny and also have mucus in it. But there is a potential route, and everybody figures this out, that the sperm have to get from the outside to the inside also, because this is where the sperm fertilizes the eggs. They enter the peritoneal cavity through the fallopian tubes. When the follicle on the ovary containing the egg ruptures, it actually ruptures into the peritoneal cavity. Sometimes a little blood and fluid goes along with it, and occasionally this can cause an irritation during the time of ovulation. But this space is where the sperm and egg meet. I may go over the details in another podcast, but essentially the fallopian tubes actually sweep the peritoneal cavity looking for the eggs so that the egg and sperm have a better chance of uniting. This is one reason that only having one good functioning fallopian tube does really not decrease your chance of conception. That remaining tube sweeps up the cavity just fine. So theoretically, we could just apply air pressure into the vagina and eventually fill the peritoneal cavity with air. I don't want anybody out there to get any ideas, because nobody really does this. And there can be even the potential of an air embolism by the air entering through the endometrium and causing an air embolism. I shouldn't have to say this, but don't go around blowing a lot of air into people's vagina, especially if they happen to be pregnant. There have been deaths associated with air embolisms just by doing this.
Upon reflection, we do inject things into the peritoneal cavity all the time. Many of you have heard of a hysterosalpingogram. This is a procedure by which we inject a radio-opaque dye into the endometrial cavity in order to check to see if the fallopian tubes are open. When we're doing this procedure, we can see the dye go up through the tubes and empty into the peritoneal cavity, and thus coat some of the organs which are covered by the peritoneum. The dye is then eventually absorbed by the body through the peritoneal wall.
So remember once I talked about the skin. It separates you from the outside, just like the digestive tract and the gut separate what you eat from your inside. Both of them are keeping you away from the external environment, and both have potential to let things enter from the external environment, especially your gut, otherwise you would starve to death. So you could consider the peritoneal cavity in a similar manner. It separates the outside, being that which enters through the vagina, uterus, and fallopian tubes, from the inside, that being the organs in your abdominal cavity. So now you can see this conduit has to exist because the sperm start on the outside and somehow get to the inside. But if you think about it, there are all kinds of things on the outside. Bacteria, virus, environmental pollutants. Most of these are much smaller than sperm. Now, the sperm get very good at it. In fact, studies have been done that it does not take long to recover sperm inside the peritoneal cavity after they have been deposited in the cervical mucus. I'm talking about 30 minutes, which is not long when you're talking about a microscopic sperm. It's like you walking a couple miles. Several of these tests were done on people having an elective hysterectomy. In other words, just before the surgery, we deposited some sperm in the cervical mucus. Then we opened up the abdomen and we checked to see if the sperm were inside the abdominal cavity, meaning in the peritoneal cavity. When you're lying down, it appears most of this sperm collects in what's called the cul-de-sac. This is a little space
underneath the uterus and on top of the rectum. And when you are lying down on your back, the sperm seems to collect there. Earlier, when I said the fallopian tubes sweep the peritoneum, it's more like they brush the peritoneum, in that they have no ability to move on their own, but are easily moved about the peritoneal cavity with normal activity and also peristalsis of the bowels. When you're lying down, they tend to rest right in this cul-de-sac, where the sperm also coincidentally seem to rest.
Well, everyone was very impressed with the sperm and determined that the swimming action propelled it along without any difficulties. Then someone got the idea of putting other things in the cervical mucus that were about the size of sperm. Initially, we put little carbon granules there, and lo and behold, the same thing happened. About 30 minutes later, they're inside the abdominal cavity. Then we put little teeny plastic balls there, and lo and behold, the same thing happened. It does appear that during certain parts of the menstrual cycle, that being the day surrounding ovulation, that your body actually wants the sperm to get inside the peritoneal cavity and facilitates it by microvilli propelling it along, whether it can swim or not. But it also ends up that to fertilize the egg, it requires more than just getting into the peritoneal cavity. Then you have to have motile sperm. So if some infertile patients don't have motile sperm, getting the sperm and the egg to meet up is still not enough. We know other things can get there. Sometimes bacteria can get into the peritoneal cavity and cause a tubal infection. Perhaps other organisms have also made their way there. But the peritoneal cavity does have some defense. It has white cells there, and it can attract more white cells if need be. It also has all kinds of chemicals residing there, just to prevent this type of action from taking place. We have to have an opening from the inside to the outside to reproduce, yet we don't want other organisms taking advantage of that opening. Hence, there are all sorts of barriers along the way. Now, back to tampons. Well, back to them, we haven't talked about them at all. Most of you are familiar with the composition of tampons and how some of the stuff in the tampon may or may not be good for you. Even oxygen, bleach, natural cotton, which sounds like a good alternative, but we really don't have any studies verifying that it's completely benign. I say this because one of the main outcomes we want to prevent is ovarian cancer. Some things we know cause cancer. Some things we are not sure one way or the other. I may have forgotten to tell you that the peritoneum is composed of mesothelium. These are mesothelial cells, connective tissues, different types of fluids and cells. It's very thin, but I would be surprised if none of you have heard of mesothelioma. This is a cancer of these cells, and generally we're talking about the peritoneum that cover the lungs, or the pleura. It ends up that we think one of the main causes of mesothelioma is asbestos. Asbestos is a fibrous compound, which is nice because we used to make things out of asbestos, but these asbestos fibers can sometimes be very small, even sperm size. Let's go to talcum powder. Baby powder has different compositions, but is mainly magnesium silicate, which is a fibrous material similar to asbestos and often found in the same underground deposits. It would therefore not be surprising if when they started out making baby powder, there was a little asbestos contamination. Now, remember, they've been making baby powder for 100 years, and at that time, nobody was really worried anything about asbestos. So, it would not be surprising if you use talcum powder around the vaginal opening, that you may get a little in the vagina, and you may get a little into the peritoneal cavity. We have long known that women who have had a tubal ligation have a marked decrease in ovarian cancer, further adding to the thinking that some ovarian cancer may be more of an environmental exposure disease. All right, now before we start freaking out, let's think about this a little. Sure, we showed that tiny carbon granules can get transported into the abdominal cavity, but we didn't try this on women who were menstruating at the time. Everything is going in the opposite direction then. I believe the study results would have been different, and that's why no one did it under those conditions. Your body is well designed with great capacity for natural healing. Reproduction may be enhanced if during certain parts of the menstrual cycle or under certain hormonal effects, the sperm is able to rapidly access the peritoneum, but one of these times is not when the endometrial lining is shedding. We also all know that sticky cervical mucus indicates a progesterone effect, and hence is not the right time for sperm to start climbing the ladder. So the vast majority of tampon usage is not going to happen during the times of ideal transport of sperm into the peritoneum. Now, there is some usage of tampons outside of menses, and if this is done during an estrogenic phase of the cycle, I believe that it may be a possibility that you are exposing the peritoneal cavity to some environmental elements. The subject of the podcast was raised because of the lawsuit showing or indicating that some women may have had an increased risk of developing ovarian cancer secondary to talcum use. If they had been doing this for many years, it is possible that some of the talcum was contaminated with some asbestos in the talcum. Modern talcum does not have any asbestos and is specifically checked for during its manufacture. The women who develop cancer may have been using the talcum powder throughout their menstrual cycle. Perhaps they sweated a lot or they had big thighs, but they were using it not during their menses, but also during times of the cycle when the sperm may have had ready access to the peritoneal cavity. For those same conditions, the talc may have had access. If that talc were indeed contaminated with asbestos, the asbestos may have had access. But this is only part of the story. Tampons have been used in some form for thousands of years, and they have been made out of hundreds of different compositions. Even if you say, I'm just going to use natural fibers, do you think any of that cotton is something like Roundup? Or perhaps some other industrial chemicals? Tampons are not a natural product and are manufactured, and in general there are several additives, although you wouldn't know that by looking at the label because it doesn't really tell you what's in it. Of course, most tampons are used during the menses, so that would make it very unlikely that something could go upstream. Although, I have to say, not impossible. Let me wrap this up.
For thousands of years of recorded history, there is not a lot of mention of things we now call tampons. Although it would be logical for us to guess that women did try to put different things in the vagina to try to control the menstrual flow. Women put things in the vagina to try to prevent pregnancy, and even perhaps rudimentary IUDs. I do not think for most of history that we had baby powder. After the modern tampon was invented and adopted, they have been of great practical benefit. We do know that there are a few toxic ingredients found in tampons, including aluminum, various fragrance compounds, various hydrocarbons, and especially dioxin. Dioxin has been well studied and is related to various cancers. This can be present in tampons as a result of rayon manufacture and also the bleaching of cotton. Now, we know this is a very low dose and probably does no harm to the vagina was inserted. I'm sure these were tested and found to be safe. But I don't think they tested the effect of dioxin when it was applied to the peritoneal cavity. As I mentioned, this probably never happens if you are just using tampons downstream. If not, there may be slight exposure.
So the health risk, I would say, would be somewhat minimal. The same with baby powder. Although new formulations are quite pure, using powder often in the peritoneal region may not be the wisest thing to do. I mean, you can use it on your feet, armpits, stomach, thighs, and on actual babies if you wish, and this probably is a very low-risk exposure. But I do believe during the right phase of the cycle, some of this may be able to be transported internally. We are now a lot smarter than we used to be, especially now that we begin to recognize the conduit into the peritoneal cavity, and perhaps we should be a little careful about what we make these tampons out of. And in fact, nowadays, the manufacturers are careful about what is going on because they do recognize this potential risk. However, this risk is so small, I'm not going to advise any women to quit using tampons, especially if you buy them at the store and don't try to make your own. If you do happen to be making your own, thinking that this may be safer, remember that cotton, which is mostly used to make these tampons, may have all kinds of chemicals attached to it that you do not know about because they're not on the label. So the bottom line is, use tampons, especially modern tampons, and use your common sense to figure out which one to use. Use the tampons during your menstrual cycle, most of the time. Occasionally you may have to use them outside the menstrual cycle, but most of the time just try to use them during the menstrual cycle. Go ahead and use modern talc powder. I'm pretty sure that doesn't contain any asbestos. At the same time, I wouldn't spread it all over my peritoneum and thighs every day for 20 years. There should be little risk during the menstrual cycle times. I do believe there is an environmental component to ovarian cancer, and that exists via the conduit between the outside and the peritoneal cavity. I am not sure what that contaminant is or could be that would induce it, although I'm pretty sure that asbestos would. The science is continually evolving, and I am not willing to say ovarian cancer is a venereal disease.
Speaking of which, I have not mentioned condom use. These are actually typically used during the fertile part of the cycle, right at the time when it's easiest to transport things into the peritoneal cavity. Condoms may contain some type of lubrication, and nobody really pays attention to what that is. I imagine there are some condoms that do contain traces of powder on their outside. Condoms have been made of numerous substances, and modern condoms are typically manufactured from some type of chemicals. Their manufacturing process may contribute to small particles being shed, and there could be some chemical contamination on the outside. Most of the time, condoms do not have a complete list of ingredients. Don't get riled up. I am not going to say do not use condoms. But still, like tampon use, there is a small risk versus benefit. Since condom use does cover the penis, it will stop any environmental toxins present on the penis from entering into the fallopian tubes. So overall, you would have to say condoms are safe and well worth the benefit. I would not buy the cheapest ones possible, especially if they are made in China. I have taught you a little functional anatomy and perhaps some processes you may not have thought much about. I am going to count on your common sense to use this information in your everyday life. Try to remember the anatomy because I may use it later in another article. Now my standard disclaimer. I may not be a real doctor, so nothing I have told you should be considered medical advice. I don't believe I've deliberately told you anything is false, but I also did not necessarily fact-check everything I said. Even without fact-checking, this article could be value to you, and I count on your common sense. Usually, this is the place where I give my ad for the book I am promoting, which is Diet and Health, and to be located at kellygregg.com, but in fact, that book has nothing to say about any of the subjects I have discussed today. So unless you're interested in diet, there's really no reason to go there. Wait a minute, I said no reason. I guess that's not true. I forgot I have another podcast on health topics, and there may be other podcasts there or articles there that may interest you, that also have nothing to do with diet.